Dr. Hargrave, it is great to see you once again. We talked about a year ago or so. I mean, you and I have talked several times since then, but you've actually taken the bait to agree to join this again to talk about Omnichannel. For those of you who don't know Dr. Hargrave, go ahead and introduce yourself and let the folks know who you are.
Hey, Mike. Well, hey, thanks for having me on. You know, despite the disaster the last time I was on your show, you invited me back. So thanks for inviting me back again. and you know, since we're giving weather reports, I'm in Washington, D.C. today, and it is raining here today. So
love it.
I guess maybe it's going to move your way or something. But I'm happy to be here. I've known Mike for a very long time, and when I was at the University of Arkansas and then through my days at Auburn, and now serve happy to serve as the president of the University of Memphis for the last 2 years.
Incredible. Incredible. What are you doing in Washington, D.C.? You're supposed to be in Memphis, solving all Memphis's problems, right?
Well, you know, part of the way we can solve those problems in Memphis is through our representation here in Washington, D.C. So I get up here. You know, a few times a year and visit with our delegations and make sure that they are aware of what's important to us. And I think we've got a really good reception from our congressmen and women and our senators. And it's just part of what we have to do as a university and part of what I have to do as a president.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So I've known you. You mentioned it. So let's just build on that. You and I met when we started doing this crazy innovative technology called radio frequency identification. I think it was like 2003, 2004, something like that. You were part of the University of Arkansas staff. You had the leadership and initiative to start at the University of Arkansas RFID lab.
Yeah.
And then you said, well, bigger opportunities await us, so I'm going to go to Auburn. And you became the dean of the business school at Auburn. And not only did you do that, but you brought the lab with you, which is fascinating how you pulled that one off, which was outstanding. And then got promoted to provost of Auburn. And then just recently, I guess a couple of years ago, got a chance to take a role as the president of the University of Memphis. What in the world? And then somehow you have time to stay relevant to all of this omnichannel and RFID retail technologies. Do you ever sleep? I mean, how in the world do you get all this stuff done? Crazy.
You know, Mike, I'm blessed that I've been able to, in my time in higher education, to kind of straddle that fence between higher education and industry. And I'm going to correct you, Mike. And so don't get upset when I correct you on something. It was before RFID that you and I worked together. You forget that the class that I was teaching, we did a project on Retail Link when you were at PFG, and you were the representative. I have class projects, and you just beat those poor students up. And that was, I believe, Mike, that was 1999. So,
oh my gosh, I completely forgot about that. Yes, so, I do remember that.
Yeah. And so anyway, so for all those joined us today, Mike and I have known each other for a very long time. And Mike's an incredible voice and force in retail. And I'm blessed to be here as well. But, you know, Mike, it has been one of these interesting journeys where I've transitioned from business before I went in higher education and just been able to kind of do both and work with great companies like Walmart, and got started with Walmart in their RFID project when they made that announcement in 2003. And they've just kind of kept with it along the way. And, you know, RFID has broadened up to, you know, certainly be a tool, but, you know, just beyond that, you know, retail technologies and things that I know we'll talk about today with, you know, serialized data and identification and all those things. So, the lab started as a genesis there from Walmart in 2003, and when they started that effort and announced that they wanted their top 100 suppliers tagging pallets and cases, Dan Phillips was at Walmart at that time as a VP, and I was doing some projects for Walmart, and Dan said, hey Bill, I was at Walmart so much, and what happened to be up there, and Dan saw me walking by, pulled me in, and said, hey Bill, what do you know about RFID? And I said, well, I can spell it. And he said, good enough. You know, let's get you, I want you to get started on this project. And, you know, and things just took off from there. And, you know, Walmart wanted us to have a lab there at the University of Arkansas to help the suppliers, because, you know, you think back 2003, nobody really knew what this technology was. And Walmart was certainly on the forefront of that. So we had, you know, the first foray that we did in the lab was to help the suppliers know how do you tag a pallet and a case at that time. And of course, it's we the lab has kept that laser focus on, you know, the business value of RFID, right? It's just, you know, how do you make that technology work for you? How do you get business value out of it? And the lab is, as you said, we grew a lot at Arkansas, and then when I made the move to Auburn, it followed followed me to Auburn, and you know, Justin Patton and the crew down there in Central have just done a fantastic job at that lab.
100% agree. Couldn't say it better. By the way, that lab I was talking, I'm still very actively involved with the lab, as you are as well. Play a very important role, and continuing to kind of lead that work, et cetera. Justin told me the other day he has over 100 students now working part-time, not only on internal projects, but projects with retailers, with brandos, et cetera. And just to probably put you on the spot and embarrass you, one of the key ones is your son. He is following in your footsteps and doing a lot of really, really great stuff. And it's just amazing, because you think about universities, the primary role of a university, even though you're in Washington doing whatever you're doing today, is to educate and equip students to take jobs in the industry. Yep. What a great way to have 100 students working on projects with retailers. If you think they're going to hire somebody, who they're going to hire? The person they've been working with the last 6 months. It's just an incredible opportunity. And your son is just doing some great stuff at the various companies he's been working with.
Yeah, you know, and that's been the focus, you know, since we started the lab, is it's always been predominantly housed by students. I mean, that's who serves mm-hmm. as the workers there. And it's, you know, mm-hmm. we've only had a handful of full-time workers over its 20-year life. And it's all been students. I mean, think about this. In its 20-year life, thousands of students have worked at the lab and moved mm-hmm. on to great jobs in industry and you know, graduate school and that type of thing. And it, you know, makes me feel a little old, Mike, that my son was 2 years old when I started this effort.
Oh, my gosh. Come here, Gavin. I want to put a tag in your diaper. Let's see what chase you around the house with. Oh my goodness, that's crazy. Well, let me one more kind of just career. You've got to have people that are assistant professors, associate professors, mm-hmm. thinking about moving in, who are coming to you and going, "How do I go from what I am today to being the president of the university?" What are your keys to success? What are the kinds of things you would tell them in terms of, hey, I want to follow what you've tried to do and the career progress you've made? Talk to us about what are the key success factors from your point of view?
Well, you know, I wish I could say that I had a plan and executed on that plan. But, you know, Mike, throughout my career, I've just been open when a door opens to look at that opportunity, and you know, sometimes you say no thanks, but more often than not, I looked at it and said, okay, that, you know, I can do that, and that looks a little bit different, and you know, I would have never dreamed that I would have been a president of a university, and never dreamed that I would have been in higher education. You know, I first in my family to go to college, actually first in my family to graduate high school, and so for me to have that, I didn't have that vision, because I you know, you can't be what you can't see. And I never saw that. And so just fortunate that all along my career, you know, people have been put in my path and have opened some doors. And you know, I've just, you know, one thing my dad did teach me, my dad was a construction worker, was, just work hard and hard work, you know, makes up a lot. And you know, Mike, you've been around me a long time. You know, I'm not the smartest person in the room, but I can outwork most. And I still hold on to that today. I'm not afraid of hard work. I'm going to do hard work. And you know, I try to treat others as I want to be treated. I as a leader, I've always been a servant leader, which means I put others in front, you know, front of what I'm trying to do. And, yep. you know, on a daily basis, and I've said this actually since I've been a dean and provost and now president, is I tell everybody who works at the university, whether it's somebody who's cutting the grass or somebody's a VP, I tell them two things. My job is as president, and when it was provost and dean, same thing, two things: get you the resources you need to do your job and remove the hurdles for you so you can do your job.
Wow.
And people need to let me know what resources they need or what hurdles get in their way, and I'll do my best to take care of those.
That's tremendous. One of my favorite questions when I had people reporting to me was, what's hope look like? And there's a lot of people that can't answer that. Oh, I'm good. No,
what does
you
what?
Have a list. What's help look like? What does help look like?
If
you come in here and lay out these challenges you've got, but then you can't answer the question, what's help look like? Then go think about that question, because I want to help you, but you got to tell me what help looks like, because otherwise I'll do stuff that doesn't look like help.
That's awesome.
Well, let's get into omnichannel, because we could talk for another 45 minutes on just this kind of career advice. But in addition to your day job, which is running a full-time university, which is incredible, you've also had the ability to have your, as we talked before, very, very laser focused on retail technology, retail supply chain, retail, specifically RFID. And that's morphed into more of an omnichannel focus, because part of the technology suite that solves product location and knowing what you have and where's it located in the store also can be used to use that for omnichannel purposes. So the purpose of this is really just to talk about the state of omnichannel. And that's really where you've spent a lot of your time over the last several years, just focusing on omnichannel. So tell us a little bit about the omnichannel business. Why did you choose this field, and how has it changed over time?
Well, at least from this idea of channels, right? And you think about the work we were doing at Walmart, and at the time that we were doing that, right? You think about the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, the internet, you know, had been around, but it was really at an early age, right? Think about, you know, 2003, 2004, the iPhone didn't exist, right? So having everything in the palm of your hand didn't exist. And so what we saw was that, you know, retailers, you know, who had traditional channels, and, you know, then it, you know, they started adding these e-commerce channels. In fact, Mike, do you have a slide there. If you pull up that first slide, I think that it might put some context here.
Yep. Matt, you're going to have to let me participate on the screen sharing, please. Go ahead and talk through it, and while we get that up.
Yeah. So we had retailers who had traditional channels, you know, again, the Walmart, the Target, you know, Macy's of the world, who had storefronts, and people came in, and, you know, what we think about is traditional retail. And then, you know, then we had the growing e-commerce, of course, Amazon would come to mind, but, you know, many others at the time. And what we saw then during that time was traditional retailers like Walmart adding an e-commerce channel. And one of the things that most retailers did, and Walmart did this, was it was actually a completely separate business unit. And I mean, completely different team, different systems, different locations, and they treated it as two different things. And that's fine, because you went from a single channel to multiple channels, but the channels didn't interact. The e-commerce, if you bought something from online store, you know, retailer A online, the traditional didn't have any visibility into that, and vice versa. And in fact, we saw retailers, Mikey, I know you saw this, is that they built fulfillment centers that were just for the online business, and there was no crossover of those things. And so there you go. Got it. And so what we saw then was, you know, that was certainly value add, but it created these multi-channels. And so we saw these proliferations, and then what we saw was, well, the pure online, you think about those, that's still a uni-channel, right? Still one channel. So an Amazon was just one channel. Well, mm-hmm. You can't serve the vast majority of customers with just one channel. So we started seeing Amazon, right, add physical spaces. And we saw that even with, you know, you think about Warby Parker and all, you know, other places where they started just online, they realized, oh, wait a second, we've got to have multiple channels. So we went from, you know, unichannel and traditional e-commerce to multi-channel, but they weren't truly integrated, and they didn't have one view of the customer, and they didn't treat inventory the same across those channels. And that's really what led to omni-channel, right? This idea of omni-channel, you know, having the product when, how, and where she wants it, and having one seamless view of that customer. And so in doing so several years ago, if you go to the next slide, I came up with something that, you know, Justin, the guys at the lab, you like to joke about. And if they're watching today, I can guarantee you they're falling out of their chair laughing, because this is what I call the omni-channel house. And I did this to try to put it in simple perspective of, hey, what are the pieces to being an omni-channel retailer? And this grew out of a time. I think I first did this slide, Mike, in at the time I made this house. I think it was in 2016. This was how long
ago
we started talking about omni-channel. And at the time that I did this, I think about 80% of them at that time said, oh, yeah, we're omni-channel. Well, we don't have any 80% of them are omni-channel today. And, you know, and I think it was just maybe more wishful thinking than anything. But this kind of lays out, hey, what do you need to be omni-channel? And it's in this whole idea of you've got to have inventory accuracy. And I'm sure we'll talk about that. And I put RFID-enabled inventory accuracy because I still believe that the only way you get reliable, accurate, and cost-efficient way to have inventory accuracy is via RFID. You've got to blend the physical and digital channels together. You have to have visibility to that single unit. And then you have things like buy online, pick up in store, and ship from store, which are characteristics. And there's other characteristics there. All of that, of course, leading to that, you know, that superior customer experience. But this was just, you know, something to show to say, look, if you're thinking about omnichannel, you can't start say, well, I've got buy online, pick up in store, and that's what I'm going to do, and that makes me omnichannel. No. You've got to have interaction. You've got to blend the digital and physical channels. You've got to have visibility of that single unit, and then you can do these other things.
I know we're going to get to this here in a little bit, but what I find interesting is you started this conversation off saying when we first started, devices like this were not even available.
Right.
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 And really the retailer was in control of the messaging and the product assortment, et cetera. Now your superior customer experience is almost at the bottom of this. It's foundational because if I want a specific item, I have no longer have any connections to retailer. My loyalty is not to the retailer. My loyalty is the item I'm looking for because I have all kinds of options with this device.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that would be very interesting is, you know, we'll get into some of this later, but the folks who don't get that, if they're in retail and don't think that that availability is ultimately in the responsibility of the customer, wake up. Because you're not going to be around long because people have options. And if you don't carry it, they're going to use your Wi-Fi and order it from somebody else and have it delivered to their house. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And Mike, that's, you know, one of the things we have to think about from a historical perspective as well. You know, there's generally what we see is the three eras of retail. And you think about when retail, you know, the beginnings of retail. And, you know, let's just go back. I mean, retail has been around for a long time, but let's just go back to the, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s, retail 1.0. Suppliers were in charge, right? Those who made the products, because they decided who could sell their products and for how much they would charge. Mm-hmm. And then as we got more retailers involved and the retailers got bigger, well, then we shifted to retail 2.0 where retailers were in charge, right? Because then retailers decided what to sell and how much to charge.
Yep.
But now, in the last 10 years, we have clearly shifted to retail 3.0, where customers are in charge.
Yep.
Customers, to your point, and that's why I wanted to bring this up, because customers demand anywhere, anytime, any product retailing. And if you as a retailer don't have it, or don't have it where I want it, when I want it, they will use this and they'll find it.
Yeah.
Right. And there is the customer's in charge. And if you're a retailer who doesn't believe that, you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Well, you've got a couple of practical examples here and a couple of other slides about how it's evolved and changed. I think this would be really helpful to have you cover these. Talk to us the importance of inventory accuracy in the traditional model, and then what does it mean when we go to an omni-channel platform?
Well, and thanks for putting up the slides. You know, one of the things that we've looked at for some time is how important inventory accuracy is. But, you know, for those who've been around retail for a long time, inventory accuracy was just one of those things that you accepted as, well, it's not going to be real accurate. And you actually, retailers built business processes around having inaccurate inventory information.
Yeah.
And I kind of laugh because it seems silly to do that, but in the absence of being able to have good inventory, actually, you have to build systems around it, right? And inventory accuracy outside of an omnichannel is pretty straightforward. So you think about a store, and it's just a storefront, you know, traditional retail. Well, inventory accuracy obviously impacts your forecast and your replenishment, which impacts your product availability, your customer satisfaction, your sales. It's pretty straightforward. And we know that, hey, if we can turn that dial on inventory accuracy, well, we can really very quickly impact sales. And we saw that in a non-omnichannel environment in the early days of RFID, if retailers going, holy cow, I can get my inventory accuracy from 65% to 98%? Whoa, that unlocks, right, a lot of this customer experience and sales. But when you then layer in omnichannel and the things that come with omnichannel that we just, you know, I showed you from the omnichannel house, if you can go to the next slide, it gets much more complicated. Right? Because inventory accuracy then plays a much bigger role, because it's not just about your forecast replenishment, but it's about, well, can I ship from the store? Do I have it in the store? Can I have visibility to it at the store? That impacts the inventory that we have. It impacts the buy online, pick up in store, and research online, buy in store. All of that, which then impacts, you know, suspicious unplanned purchases, it becomes a much more complicated but much more impactful element in the journey to increasing your sales. And that's where RFID that we've seen, you know, when you turn that dial from 65% to 98%, for example, well, that changes what you can do as a retailer. And conversely, Mike, in an omnichannel world, if you have poor inventory accuracy, you're in a world of hurt. Because you can't do such things as be effective at buy online, pick up in store. You can't be effective in ship from store. And if you can't do those, your competitors will figure out a way to do it.
Great point. So you got a couple terms here. I think people have heard of BOPIS before, which is buy online, pick up in store. You very quickly said research. What is ROPIS? I know – I've heard it before many times, but I'm not sure the audience has. What is ROBIS?
So ROBIS is research online, buy in store. And it's a pretty simple concept, because I'm sure that most everybody who listening and watching today has done that. And that's where you say, look, I want to go buy a new toaster. Let me go see if Walmart has what they have in toasters and what they have. Oh, I like this one. Do they have it in stock? And I researched six different toasters. I found the one I want. It shows it's in stock. Now I'm going to drive to Walmart and pick it up. 74% of retailers, 74% of consumers last year did that at least one time. And what we know is that number, you know, you get in the habit of doing that. I do it all the time. Before I go to the store and buy something of any consequence, even something like a toaster, I'll go online, find what I'm looking for, then see if it's in stock. And you know what, Mike, if I went to if I found the toaster I wanted and I went to Walmart and said, you don't have that one stock, you know where I what I do? Then I look at Target and I say, okay, does Target have, oh, no, they don't have it. I will find a retailer has it and I'll drive there and buy that. Without good inventory accuracy, right, retailers aren't showing that inventory, you're missing out. I mean, retailers really miss out on these, and we call those hidden lost sales, because you don't, as a retailer, you don't even know that you've lost that sale because you never gave that opportunity for that sale to ever occur.
They came in, they looked around, they left empty handed. They have no idea you disappointed them. None.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. It's because this isn't like adding something to the cart, you know, and then abandoning your cart. You can keep up with that as a retailer, but you don't know when somebody comes in, looks around and abandons and, you know, just drops out of your website because they saw that you didn't have that in stock, right? There's nothing, there's no way to know that. So there's this hidden cost to poor inventory accuracy.
All right. Here's the big question.
Yep.
You just said 74%. I never heard that number before. 74% of consumers routinely log on to check availability of product.
Yep.
But my perception is very few retailers have the courage or systems to deliver that data. Talk to us a little bit about that, because I can think of three or four retailers that actually say only three left, one left. Most of them say check store for availability, which is just frustrating because you're basically saying, I'm not telling you, even if I know.
Yep.
Talk to us about that trend, because if we've got 74% of shoppers, customers routinely looking for that, what about the ones that don't do that? And what are the potential risks in terms of their, you know, loyalty?
Well, so you know, that number is, you think about it, right? 74% of consumers went out and researched online before they wanted to go to the store and buy. And at first you look at that number and go, wow, that's a really high number. But think about it, right? I mean, we almost everyone does that now at some point, right? Mm-hmm. In the retail, whatever they may be buying. But now then the flip side of that is, as of last year, and we did a pretty extensive study in the last few years on buy online, pick up in store, mm-hmm. only 17% of the retailers as of last year, when we last updated the study, actually displayed in-store quantities on their website.
Wow.
So now, let's say I've done a research online buy in store, right? And I go looking for this toaster. Now, retailers who are confident in their inventory, we're seeing them put their inventory out there, and they say, yeah, we have three, you know, quantity is three. But we'll see others, it'll just say in stock. And they don't tell you how many's in stock. And then you have the question, do you really have it in stock? And, you know, I've had experience, and I shared this at a presentation I did late last year, where I was buying a ladder. And I won't mention the home improvement store, but a ladder. These are big, big things, right? And I was looking at a particular ladder. The local home improvement store said, yes, we have it. So I went to the store to get this ladder. I go in, can't find this ladder anywhere. So I find somebody, chase somebody down. You know, it takes a while to find somebody to actually help you in the store. Say, hey, I'm looking for this ladder. You know, they've got their little handheld. They said, oh, yeah, we've got six of them. So my first thought was, well, if you show on your handheld that you have six of them, why don't you show me online that I have six of them? But that's a separate issue, right? Mm-hmm. Well, we've got six of them. So, well, where are they? They looked all over the place. Couldn't find.
Mm-hmm.
How do you lose six ladders? And I walked out of there empty-handed. They didn't. Right. They did not have. So, but Mike, the reason I share that is for two reasons. One is the showing it online, but two, their inventory was so inaccurate. The reason they didn't show me the quantity online, because they didn't actually know how many they had.
Mm-hmm.
They thought they had six, so they thought it was safe to at least online say, yeah, we're in stock. But now here's the downside of that. Do you think I'll go back to that home improvement retailer the next time I need something like that? No, because I don't trust that they will have
it
when I get there.
Yeah. By the way, did you find the ladder?
I went to another home improvement center.
Did they expose the on-hands?
Yes, they did, actually. Yes.
Okay. Were they right?
While I was standing in the store, frustrated at the first one, I went online, found it at the second one. It showed me that I went over there and I actually bought it.